From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. A new culture of foodies and environmentalists has helped to popularize organic, locally sourced food. And as the foodie community grows in the region, so does the divergence between the people who can afford to make healthier, more sustainable choices and the people who suffer from food insecurity, either not knowing where the next meal is coming from or having to make choices between paying an electric bill or buying food. Today, we're going to explore the realities of food insecurity in southeastern North Carolina, how this struggle contributes to health issues like obesity, and whether there are alternative ways of producing food that might offer greater access to healthy food. Today, we have two people in studio to guide us on this exploration. Jill Wadey is an assistant professor of sociology in UNCW's Sociology and Criminology Department. Jill Wadey, welcome to Coastline.
Thanks.
Also with us today, Evan Folds is president of Progressive Farms and Progressive Gardens in Wilmington. He's also a member of the board of directors of the Title Creek Co-op in Wilmington. Evan Folds, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
If you have a question or a comment about growing food or food scarcity in southeastern North Carolina, you can send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. You can also give us a call at 910-343-1138. Jill Wadey, let's talk about food insecurity so people who are not familiar with food deserts and that issue in this region can understand it. What is a food desert in the first place?
Well, the USDA defines a food desert as a low-income census tract, which is just one way to measure geography, that is a mile from a grocery store for an urban area and 10 miles for a rural area. So you have limited access to a grocery store if you live in these food desert areas. And the low-income designation is important because they might have less access to transportation, for example.
And how does living in a food desert contribute to a health issue like obesity or being overweight or the myriad health issues that go along with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, living in a food desert is associated with a higher rate of both food insecurity and obesity. Food insecurity and poverty are also closely related, so that's where you see the low-income designation come in. But if you can't access healthy and affordable food, then you're going to have higher rates of food insecurity, not getting access to food, and then you also might have higher rates of obesity. That might seem counterintuitive, but it's because you don't have money to buy these higher quality foods, so you end up buying cheaper, more calorie-dense foods that are less healthy, and that can lead to rates of obesity.
For example, the kinds of foods you're talking
about.
Oh,
so right. So if you are more likely to go to a fast food restaurant or buy something from a convenience store instead of some fresh fruits and vegetables or lean meats that you might buy from a grocery store.
Evan Folds, you started Progressive Gardens, you said 13 years ago, because you noticed that there was a dearth of sustainable farming that produced nutrient-dense food. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. I think that was the first realization that I had is I learned about hydroponics and how simple it was to grow plants and really kind of discovered for myself that that didn't happen at that moment. And it just kind of made perfect sense, you know, cleaner food, closer to people. And that's really what kind of drives us today, for sure.
And what are some alternative ways? We'll get into the details of this as the show goes on, but what are some ways that people in this region can produce food in urban or suburban settings? Because a lot of people think of this area as just sandy and impossible to grow.
Yeah, well, the first thing is to realize the importance of soil. If your soil's not right, you can't grow high-quality food. So we do a lot of consulting for backyard gardeners, home gardeners that allow, you know, using compost teas, starting a compost pile, using organic fertilizers to feed the microbes that make those compost and compost teas, and really getting the soil growing, forget the plants almost. So, you know, that's really the number one thing, and the success of that really comes through having the right perspective of how to establish all of that, and that's really what we do in a nutshell.
Jill Wadey, what are some of the barriers to getting help with access to food here? We know that there are food deserts here. Do you know how many there are?
Yeah, so in New Hanover County, well, in the Wilmington area, 6 census tracts are designated as food deserts, and then there's a couple more in the outskirts. If you look at the region of southeastern North Carolina, we have 3 persistently poor counties, Bladen, Columbus, and Robeson County, so they have a lot of food deserts in those areas, too. So you do see high rates in this area. Some of the challenges are getting grocery stores to build in some of these areas. They might not feel like they're able to recoup the costs for building in these areas. And another difficulty might be getting access to these quality fresh fruits and vegetables, which is why some of these farmers markets programs are really important.
Well, it's so interesting that you mentioned Columbus, Robeson, Bladen County. These are some of the more rural counties that are part of this listening area. They're part of southeastern North Carolina. You're saying they're farming communities, and yet there isn't widespread access to quality fruits and vegetables and healthy foods. That sounds counterintuitive. Can you explain that?
I mean, it is counterintuitive, but it's not everyone is farming, right? It makes up a small percentage of the people in the communities, and they might not be farming fruits and vegetables for consumption. They might be farming other things. Since they're rural, they're geographically dispersed, so people are living farther from a central area if they don't have access to a car or some other sort of reliable transportation, right? You don't see public transportation in those areas. It makes it really difficult for them to access a grocery store, even if there's one, like in the center of town.
Evan Folds, what do you think about some of the farming practices that we have going on the larger scales? Not talking about backyard farmers here, but farmers who do this for a living.
Yeah, well, to speak to the counterintuitiveness of your point is, you know, I think what is important to understand is that most farming as we imagine it is not really the farming that's going on around us. You know, 3% of the agricultural work revenue that is accomplished in North Carolina is actually for fruits and vegetables. The rest is for biofuels and for grains, for livestock. And even livestock itself, Christmas trees is larger than fruits and vegetables, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, you kind of have to decentralize farming to really understand the types of farming that are happening, and then you can get into the reasons for that and the subsidies and those sorts of things. But it's also a matter of just the way in which the farming is undertaken. When you monoculture and you grow one crop, like in 10,000 acres of corn, that's not really growing a nutritional product, and it streamlines from a business model standpoint. But the result is, you know, generations ago, 70% of the populace was involved in farming. That's less than 1% today. And of that 1%, 45% don't even claim it as a primary income, which is staggering. I mean, that's just a complete revolution in the way that we grow food. And what's happened is we haven't really connected ourselves to what the results of that are, which are food grown for the wrong reasons, in my view, and food grown as a commodity rather than for its nutritional quality. And that really has
what
to
do you
change
mean by
to
that?
Get to the result.
Food grown for the wrong reasons. What do you mean?
Well, I would argue that food grains grown for cows is, you know, first of all, cows don't eat grains. They eat grass. So that is done for an economic incentive. Food is generally, in my view, grown for profit and not for people. And that's something that we really have to come to terms with because, you know, one stat is if the subsidies that allow the meat industry and the livestock industry in the United States, there's estimates that a pound of meat would cost $48 if it wasn't subsidized, which would mean the quarter pounder at the drive-thru that costs 79 cents would be $12. Nobody in their right mind would be able to buy that to start with, but it wouldn't be accessible in the ways that it is. And, you know, what we were talking about earlier, these things are delivered to us in a way that makes sense for the profit of how it gets there rather than what the nutritional quality is for the people. We could, if we subsidize fruit and vegetables, the entire landscape would be different, and we would have, you know, cost-effective, nutritious food locally at people's fingertips, probably more than we would need. So it comes down to the priorities, and it also comes down to using buying power and having a populace that's educated towards how to influence those things as well.
Well, let's talk about access to healthy food for a second. Jill Wadey, we know that people who have means, people in the upper socioeconomic strata, can think about where their food comes from, and they can buy organic when they feel like it's important. But there's a whole sector of the population that can't even make that choice.
and there are a couple of assistance programs. What's the difference between WIC and SNAP, and can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, so SNAP is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. You might commonly know it as food stamps. That's what we usually call it. And WIC is Women, Infants, and Children. So that's for pregnant women, women who are nursing, and children up to 5 years old. WIC has a very specific list of what you can purchase on it, whereas SNAP gives you a certain number of dollars per month to use.
And what is the average?
For North Carolina, it's usually about $28 a week for North Carolina, which breaks down to about $1.35 per meal, and that's average. So obviously some people are getting a lot more than that, some people are getting a lot less. But if you think about it, that's really not much food for you to purchase.
So that really is just a supplement.
It's intended to supplement. Mm-hmm.
And what are some of the rules surrounding what, if I'm on the WIC program, for instance, what are some of the restrictions I have in terms of what I can buy?
Right. So for WIC, they very clearly outline what it is you can and cannot buy. So, you know, certain milk, dairy products, fruits, vegetables, meats, very clearly what you can buy with that. Whereas for SNAP, you have a lot more options for what you can buy in the grocery store. But some things is restricted, like you can't buy alcohol or anything with it.
Right. If you're talking about, you said $1.35 per meal is mm-hmm. what your SNAP assistance averages out to?
Average for North Carolina.
So that sounds like a cup of ramen noodles to fill your belly.
And that's part of the problem. It's really difficult to afford to eat healthy if you're on SNAP. And it's intended to be supplemental. But the thing is, a lot of people are making this decision, should I pay for my electricity or use that money for food? So SNAP sometimes is all the money they're spending on food.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about food deserts in the Cape Fear region, how that affects public health, and alternative ways of producing food. Evan Folds of Progressive Gardens and Jill Wadey, UNCW Assistant Professor of Sociology, are here to answer your questions. You can ask a question by calling 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and I'm here with Jill Wadey of UNCW's Sociology and Criminology Department and Evan Folds of Progressive Farms and Progressive Gardens. We're talking today about how we grow food, why so many people in the area grapple with food insecurity, and what we can do to increase access to healthy food. You can ask a question of our guests today by calling 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using Coastline HQR. And before we went to break, we were just talking about access to healthy food. There are so many components to just that discussion. There's a cost factor, and there are degrees, I imagine, too, of healthiness of food. For instance, the difference between buying a package of spinach and a package of crackers. There's a cost issue there. But when we're talking about buying healthy food, is there anything, Jill Wadey, that you can recommend right now? Is there any way that people who are educated or have creative methods can kind of get around this cost impediment? What would you suggest?
People who don't have enough money for food, what
yes.
they can do?
Yes.
Buying stuff like frozen vegetables does cost generally a little bit less than fresh vegetables, so that can be something. Going to your local farmer's market is also a good thing. We have a great program through Feast Down East that brings these fresh fruits and vegetables to some of the local Wilmington Housing Authority communities. So there's a program at Rankin Terrace, at Hillcrest, and at Solomon Towers. So that's a way for people to get access to these things at a low cost.
We have an email from Jim. He says, I like Evan's comment about foods grown for the wrong reason. The amount of energy, money, and land used to grow food for livestock is wrecking the environment. Shouldn't people who claim to be environmentalists become vegetarian to really make a positive impact on our planet? Shouldn't we grow more food for people, especially here in North Carolina? I hate getting so much food from California. Mm-hmm. Evan Folds.
Yeah, that's accurate. Pardon me. I think it really comes back to what we were talking about in the beginning is, you know, it's a different way into the same idea. It's like, you know, you can get really caught up in demonizing Walmarts and big corporations, but, you know, the reality is that they're selling what people buy. And the reason that it ends up there at the price point that makes sense for that person is kind of a separate conversation and the more important conversation. It's the policy that delivers it there. It's you know, the Big Mac costs in, you know, 79 cents instead of $12, you know. So these things drive action. And when we get into blaming ourselves and people, it's a bit of a tough conversation for me to have, because I think people got to do what they got to do. And if you can buy meat cheaper than you can get fresh vegetables, then that's unfortunately what's going to happen. So I think the bigger issue is to make sure that the people that are in a position to have influence and use their buying power to encourage these things are invited to do it. Join a community supported agriculture program. If you are on a low income and you need life force, some living foods in your diet, sprout seeds, you know, do a sprouting or wheatgrass or something like that. But you know, again, as a society, we could make these things more collectively available. So, you know, any help that we can get doing that is helpful. And it starts with perspectives like the email was suggesting. I think that's right on. I'd stop short of saying we should all become vegetarians. I personally don't eat meat, but that's, you know, for a lot of different reasons that I really wouldn't project onto anyone else personally.
You're also a board member of the food co-op Tidal Creek. Mm. And that's something that a lot of people in this area, when they think about Tidal Creek, honestly, they think about organic, possibly more exotic, certainly more expensive foods. But Tidal Creek is going through something of a shift right now. Is that right?
They are. And, you know, I would argue with the idea that it's more expensive. I think it's on par. There are certainly things that are more expensive. But for organic food, it's not more expensive. I think what we really struggle with as a co-op is the, you know, the perspective that people hold of the co-op. And I don't necessarily think it's for the wrong reasons. And part of the transition that we're looking at is how to be more inclusive. How do we meet a WIC price point when, by the guidelines of WIC, we're not allowed to sell to anyone in that program? You know, you have to buy white eggs. You cannot buy organic food on a WIC program. Now, I think the public policy on that is that it's more expensive and you're not getting as much food value out of it. But you could also arguably, I think more effectively, that the most nutritious aspects of food aren't available to those maybe that need it most. And so I think, you know, making sense of these things is a lot different than just changing our minds. It takes a village, so to speak. But Tidal Creek is looking to position itself and potentially move down into the Midtown, downtown area in what's designated as a USDA food desert. And we've got our eyes wide open. You know, we understand the community that we're moving into, and we're asking them to invite us there.
And when I think about lower income people, I don't think about them showing up at the door of a Tidal Creek saying, my dollars are just not going to go as far as they would at, say, Food Lion, but here I am. So how are you going to adjust the business model there?
Yeah, you have to address the perceptions to start, and then you got to follow through. So, you know, part of what Tidal Creek has chosen not to do in the past is to sell commodity-type products that might not align with the philosophy of the business.
And when you say commodity-type products, what do you mean?
Well, I would mean maybe not so much commodity as more name brand. You know, let's take Frosted Flakes. You know, we don't sell Frosted Flakes because Nabisco, or I'm not even sure who makes them, but these large food companies really don't have the average person's health in mind. And that sounds like a large judgment, but when you look into actually how they grow the food, I think it kind of speaks for itself. So Tidal Creek in the past has somewhat chosen the foods that aligned with the philosophy they were trying to project. Unfortunately, that doesn't hit the sweet spot of the majority of people.
Right, and the members of the co-op can afford to pay a premium for making those choices.
That's right. And, you know, in all fairness, Tidal Creek could choose to maintain that business model if we were in a market that could justify it. And what they've struggled with, not only with, you know, Whole Foods and Trader Joe's moving into the neighborhood, but the fact that there's just not enough people to pull from to maintain that business model. So there's a lot of different forces there, not to mention the location that we're in is not ideal, street frontage, that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's really a conscious shift from, you know, prejudging what people should eat, more so let's get them in the door and have a conversation, I think is an easy way to think about it. It's not that, you know, selling Frosted Flakes is a sellout. We're still going to have competitive brands that may be more nutritious or better for you. But at least we'll be able to engage people where they are and create an environment people can feel comfortable shopping in.
You're talking a little bit about outreach and education, it sounds like.
Yeah, very much so, to the point where we'll actually have offices in the building that are geared towards providing curriculum to to people to coach them through healthier eating habits, cooking habits, growing habits, et cetera. That's part of the model that we're looking to instill for sure.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about food insecurity in the region, alternative methods of farming and food production. Here in the studio to answer your questions are Jill Wadey, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UNCW, and Evan Folds, President of Progressive Farms and Progressive Gardens. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us using CoastlineHQR. Jill Wadey, are there education issues with the people who rely on food assistance programs, food pantries or food banks? Is education part of it, or is it really all financial in terms of the barriers to healthy food?
I mean, I think that's a really important question. What Evan was just saying about if Title Creek does locate somewhere downtown, having that educational component is key. A recent study from Philadelphia, they located a large grocery store in a food desert area, and 6 months after it located there, they hadn't increased the fruit and vegetable consumption of the residents in the area. It was similar to another neighborhood that didn't have the grocery store. So you can't just go in and plop down a grocery store. There's more to do than just that, right? You have to involve the local community.
Did that study, though, reveal the reasons behind why produce consumption hadn't increased? I mean, was it a financial barrier?
It was just a preliminary study. I don't know what's happened since then. Mm-hmm. I think they're trying to figure out why that's the case. But people think that the solution to food deserts is just putting in a grocery store, and that can't be the solution to everything. And we're talking about with education. Feast Down East, like I mentioned earlier, has a program, nutrition classes at Hillcrest, where they're teaching people how to cook with some of these fruits and vegetables, because if you don't know what to do with them, it's difficult. If you've never been exposed to them before, they have a community garden there, so they're growing things like kale, teaching the residents how to make kale chips. That sort of thing is really important.
Mm-hmm. Is there a time issue there, too? Because some people who rely on food stamps or other kinds of assistance have multiple jobs. They have children. And, you know, by the time they get home at the end of the day, it's all about just getting it done so they can get to bed and start over the next day.
Mm-hmm.
And often you don't think of someone in that kind of a circumstance as having the time to chop up produce and cook something and put a meal on the table. It's so much easier to go through the drive-through.
Exactly, and it's difficult. And that's why people with lower incomes, if they're trying to work multiple jobs just to survive, do have a hard time with these issues around food insecurity and obesity. So it's having the time to prepare foods, knowledge, and also there's stresses that are associated with living in these environments that you can't account for. It's just difficult all around.
What are some of those stresses that you're talking about?
Like if you're worried about your electricity getting turned off because you don't have enough money to pay for food, you know, a lot of times parents will go without so they can feed their children, right? So studies that the USDA has done measuring food insecurity, childhood food insecurity rates are always going to be lower than adults because they'll go without so their children can have some. You know, worrying about losing your job, working in these temporary employment situations, a lot of these things really come together, and not having adequate access to health care.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about food insecurity in the region, alternative methods of farming and food production. Here in the studio to answer your questions are Jill Wadey, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UNCW, and Evan Folds. He's the President of Progressive Gardens and Progressive Farms. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. Evan Folds, Consumer Reports just published an article about the dangers of pesticides on produce. And it's interesting because there's been an ongoing public debate about this. There's been some research that comes back and says it really doesn't matter that much by the time the produce gets to you. But Consumer Reports took a very strong position, saying, for instance, eating one serving of green beans grown in the U.S. is 200 times riskier than eating a serving of U.S.-grown broccoli. There are some food items that are just much, much riskier, and Consumer Reports is saying these pesticides contribute to things like ovarian cancer and prostate cancer, even depression. And granted, a lot of this research has been done on farm workers who are very close to these pesticides physically. But is that something that Tidal Creek is thinking about as they consider moving into a lower income part of Wilmington?
Absolutely. I think, you know, an effort to account for that is certified organic. Unfortunately, I've seen many different studies of, you know, 60% of, you know, back up one step. Organic is not what most people imagine it to be. It's somewhat like farming. It doesn't mandate food is better for you. Now, it happens to be better for you the majority of the time. But what it really says is what's not supposed to be there, which is, in simple terms, genetically modified foods are not allowed in organic certification, and pesticides, artificial pesticides. I've seen studies on soy in California that show 60% of the samples had genetically modified genes in them that were certified organic. And I think it was like 45% of them had multiple forms of pesticides on them. And this has to do with drift and, you know, the Pandora's box. You can't put it back in once you've allowed it out.
So just to be clear, what you're saying is certified organic, in your opinion, doesn't necessarily mean that it's pesticide-free or that it's free of the things that it says it's free of.
Well, to be clear, it's better than conventional, but it cannot guarantee it, just simply by the nature of what farming is. And not to mention, a lot of the organic standards have been diluted. You know, buying an organic pizza in Walmart, I don't think was the intention of organic farming. So it has to be watered down to be able to accomplish the business model that farming has become. And that's just kind of the elephant in the room. But yeah, at the end of the day, that, you know, you could spend a whole program on genetic modification, and let's assume it was a good thing, and to be very clear, I do not believe that it is. It's resulting in 25% more of Roundup being sprayed every single year because these crops are genetically modified to withstand these poisons so that we can then proactively go out and douse the land with it in a much more fundamental way to produce the crop, but it results in much more carcinogens in our food supply. So I think that's absolutely something Tidal Creek is focused on, to the extent where I think what you'd see from Tidal Creek that you won't see from other organizations is actually, you know, one of the efforts we're going to try to engage them on is to produce a farming model that actually meets WIC pricing, that's beyond organic but not certified, so that it can be purchased by someone that's on WIC, which is completely amazing if you think about it. We have to go out and try to do that, but that's one of the things we're thinking about doing.
What do you mean produce a farming model that can meet the WIC price points? That you're talking about who would be doing the farming?
Well, we would be. Our food farms program is about really searching for the value of space and really trying to train people to, you know, what's the minimum amount of land someone needs to farm in order to pay him a middle-class income. If we can do, which we can, about $10,000 in an average season, worst-case scenario, say 3 months, you know, if you've got 10 acres there, that's $30,000. So, you know, there's a salary in there. And so what we're searching for is a training mechanism that can attach people to space, that can follow our fertility methods, that grow the food that we've sold for them before it's grown. So the farmer just has to be a farmer. So one of the things that we could do is go out. And if you think about what, you know, what harkens back to what we started here, you know, farming's not farming. The average sharecropper pays about $75 an acre to a landowner to grow soy or corn or some kind of commodity crop. The tax value on that land's somewhere around $100. It's not even covering the nut of the space. So, you know, the landowners know this. They don't have another choice, because the reality is the sharecroppers, they're going to get their subsidy whether they harvest the crop or not. I know a 10-acre plot south in Brunswick County, and they hadn't even harvested the soybeans 3 out of the last 5 years they've grown it. Yet to the subsidy, they have to follow all the pesticide applications, the fertilizations, knowing full well they're not going to get anything out of it in order to get the subsidy check. So it's become about the subsidy check rather than the foods that's being grown. And that's just a backwards method of farming. So what we're trying to do is bring greater value to that land. Rather than, you know, pay the landowner $75, we can pay him $200 an acre. And then we can go leverage the space that we need to meet the demand of the food, which is pretty much unlimited.
And this is a program that you're developing. This is Progressive Farms,
correct,
which is your company. This is separate from Tidal Creek.
It is, yeah. Yeah, and it would work very closely with Tidal Creek as a strategic partner. You know, our model is not to go out and try to grow food for wholesalers and conventional food markets, but it's to identify people that would be willing to pay more, would be deemed more conducive to what we want to accomplish with the food, rather than just growing food to try to sell it everywhere. We want to develop partners that we're growing it for. And that model may look different depending on what the audience is.
All right. I have more questions about that, but we have a caller. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about food insecurity in the region, alternative methods of farming and food production. Here in the studio to answer your questions, Jill Wadey, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UNCW, and Evan Folds, President of Progressive Gardens and Progressive Farms. If you have a question, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email your question to coastline@whqr.org. Zach, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. How are you, Zach?
I'm great, driving on Highway 40, listening to the program.
Do you have a question for our guests?
Yeah, so we keep talking about subsidies, and they seem to be kind of like a necessary evil for getting vast quantities of food out to the public at a cheap price. And during those a cause of those subsidies seems to be the evil of why Tidal Creek won't purchase some of those products. What if there was a fundamental change in the subsidies that made organic subsidies? Would that be a bad thing could that make organic foods widely available at a cheaper price if there were subsidies for organic?
You're talking about a national public policy change, a federal governmental program, Zach, that would subsidize organics instead of some of these other crops.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
That, Evan Folds and Jill Wadey, sounds like a progressive idea, but this is something, of course, if we're talking about a national stage, we have to focus on what can be done in the local community.
Well, I think in fairness, the national stage affects what we can do in the local community. I think the point's well taken. I think if we could approach it consciously with that kind of perspective, it would change things. You can get cynical really quick here. I try not to go down those roads as often as possible. But, you know, we have a president, and I'm not picking politically here, that gives a joint session speech in Congress and never on healthcare and never mentions food. So we have to look at the priorities from the top down, and we're doing what we can to change it locally.
Zach, thanks so much for your call. His wife also started a garden at the White House, and I think that there are statistics now to say that more people are growing gardens. Whatever your politics are, she's had an influence on the number of people growing vegetables. You're listening to Coastline. If you have a question for our guests, give us a call, 910-343-1138. We're talking about alternative methods of food production and food insecurity. This is Coastline. Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn, and with me in the studio once again, Jill Wadey, Assistant Professor in UNCW's Sociology and Criminology Department, and Evan Folds, President of Progressive Gardens and Progressive Farms. We're talking about how to increase access to healthy food, particularly for those who struggle with food insecurity. If you have a question for our guest today, give us a call at 910-343-1138. Send your question in via email at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. And Jill Wadey, just in terms of this area and the state, how are we doing? Where do we rank in terms of food insecurity?
Unfortunately, North Carolina ranks 5th in the nation in terms of level of food insecurity. In the United States in 2013, the food insecurity rate was 14.3%, meaning 14.3% of Americans were either worried about where their next meal was coming from, running out of food, skipping meals, not eating for a whole day, losing weight because they didn't have enough money to afford food. North Carolina is much higher at 17.3%. As I said, we're 5th after Arkansas, Mississippi, Texas, and Tennessee. So we have pretty high rates of food insecurity, which is similar to our rate of poverty compared to the rest of the country, too.
So you're saying the reason that we're 5th in the nation in terms of food insecurity is because we have a high rate of poverty?
It's definitely one of the main reasons. poverty and food insecurity don't correlate exactly. You could be poor and have plenty to eat. You could be living above the poverty line and still be food insecure, but they're definitely related, and I think that's probably one of the reasons. In North Carolina and, you know, all of the issues we had with loss of jobs in the region, all these different issues contribute to that. And these persistent poverty counties, right? So Bladen, Columbus, and Robeson have higher food insecurity rates than even our North Carolina average.
So what are some of the other issues that would create a food insecure situation in someone's life?
Not having geographic access to food. If you not only are low income, but if you live in one of these food deserts, that's really associated with being food insecure. You know, maybe being elderly, not having access to transportation. A lot of these things definitely go together.
You're listening to Coastline, talking about food insecurity in the region. And Ed Wanda from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Or do I have Lewis from Wilmington?
Hello?
Hello.
How you doing? This is Lewis.
Hi, Lewis. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. One problem I've noticed is even though people would like to eat healthier, even if they have access, I know a lot of people have trouble with affordability. And with the problems in California and whatnot, it just seems like it's going to go up in price. And is there any kind of strategies or thinking involved to try to help get the price down for some of these people who would like to eat healthy, but they just can't simply afford it?
Evan Folds.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it speaks kind of to the crux of what we're talking about. It's not black and white, but I think the problem, first of all, is access. I think price is a factor there, but a lot of the food that we see, the price that we are experiencing is, you know, 60% of the average food product you buy in the grocery store is not food. It's the 1,500 miles of travel to get there. It's the marketing. It's the, you know, the packaging that it's in. It's everything but the food. So what we're trying to do locally, which I think the answers are locally, we're not going to get rescued by anyone from outside. They may make it easier on us, but what we're really trying to do is create a model that lives within itself that can deliver food at a price point that would be better than what you would see in the average grocery store that's grown locally. And I think part of that is what I was referencing earlier is really an intention to do that because the economics is such, and I don't have the firm grasp that I'd like yet, but we're working towards it. But as we develop this data and we actually look at the real business model of what our costs were and the value of what it was that we grew, we can then get a better understanding of how to create a model out of it that we can apply to space. It could be a rooftop, could be a backyard, it could be 20 acres, it could be anywhere. And if the model makes sense, then we can go and do it. And there would be nothing holding us back. So I think that's part of the answer. The other is making sure that we can have a policy that reinforces what we all want, and that's maybe a bigger animal than what we can do locally, I would argue.
Lewis, thanks so much for your call. And Ed Wanda from Wilmington says this seems to be more a nutritional, more than a nutritional issue, and more political. Why would we have to think politically in a business manner in order to change and improve the way we eat? And I think this is touching on that same element of the point you were just making, Evan Folds. And you also mentioned unconventional spaces for farming. And there seems to be some sort of a trend. I've heard of Freedom Lawns. I've heard of the Great Healthy Yard Project. What does this mean? Can people farm in their yards if they're living on a suburban tract of land?
Absolutely. Our version, we call it Food Lawns. And you can get a quick splash page at foodlawns.com, and we're going to develop a local website that tracks where the food is grown, where it ends up, kind of create a party out of the idea that, you know, you can tell your neighbor you can go eat your foods at RX or Pembroke's or any of these restaurants in town, or Tuttle Creek for that matter. So yeah, the problem is, and you know, a way to make the point, I think, is in maybe every day, every day this time of year, we get somebody from Ohio or New York that's moved into town that had really good soil where they were that they could take for granted, and they're doing exactly what they did at home, and they do it here, and the plant dies. And that's very common. And the reality is the development of property pretty much obliterates any kind of healthy soil that could be there to begin with, even if it was developed 50 years ago. It takes 1,000 years to make an inch of soil. So it's by law, you have to bring in 4 inches of fill, and the general contractor could care less about mineral balance and biological diversity. So the reality is you don't really have soil, you got dirt. It's kind of a simple way of thinking about it. So until you kind of get on that path of growing your soil, you really can't have the success that you want. Container gardening, hydroponics are very accessible options. But at the end of the day, our food loans program intends to be, you know, you can do all of this yourself with our help, or we can do it all for you and come to farm your landscape for you with levels of entry in between. And, it, you know, you can get involved in your local food system by growing the food or simply by eating it, you know, and create kind of an awareness towards that. And then options people can proactively lean into getting involved is what our efforts are. But, you know, people ask, what can I do in my landscape? And there's two things. One is start a compost pile. It's free. We'll give you the compost tea for free to inoculate it, and it grows soil. So that's a very accessible option, and everybody's got food waste and organic waste. And the second is just to grow one thing that you can eat, you know, even if it's just a pepper plant, and you can, you know, slice the banana pepper up and put it on your salad. That simple effort and experience of eating something that you've grown is really an intangible. You know, you can't talk about it. It's an experience. And you know, the old idea that the food you grow makes it taste better, it really does. And that's really kind of what starts the fire. And then from there, when you have success in one little thing, you can, it's just a matter of doing it again in a different way.
Or failure. We had a spring gardening show a couple of weeks ago, and we had some very experienced local gardeners who are used to this climate and, you know, the stuff that we walk around on, the dirt and the sand. And they both threw up their hands when it came to tomatoes and said, "We're not even talking about tomatoes."
Well, I would have liked to have been on that show because
so,
I could help them with that.
Tell us about that. Tell us about how, for instance, and I've known other people too who've said, tried tomatoes, they get to a certain point, and then the squirrels get them, the birds get them, or the tomato hornworms come.
Yeah, well, you got to grow enough for the pests. And so, you know, if you have a good crop, that tends to work itself out. But
really?
No, yeah, it does.
Hold on that point for a second.
Yeah.
If you grow enough tomato plants, you won't just develop a larger crop of tomato hornworms?
No, well, the hornworms are a little different. There's easy ways to manage them. Bacillus thuringiensis is a beneficial bacteria. You spray that onto your plants weekly, biweekly, and when the hornworm eats the leaf, it actually, the bacteria grows in its gut and kills it from the inside, and it's completely organic. So, you know, there's ways like that in almost every pest, but the reality is most pests, outside of maybe deer, which maybe need to be physically restrained if it's a really bad problem or you're on the deer highway, which some people are, but most pests, moles, chinch bug, ground pearl, you know, all of these things that we are told can't be killed by chemicals are all obliterated by having the soil be alive. And you want to think about, you know, in the forest, the trees don't eat the leaves. They eat what microbes make out of it. That's composting. Equally, the forest grows trees, huge trees, with no fertilizer because the soil is alive and it's organized, it's mature. So what we do conventionally when we grow gardens is, you know, we may go get some Miracle-Gro or something artificial that might grow the plant with some success, but that is working against the life in the soil. And that's really a simple takeaway from this conversation is organic gardening is not just good for the earth. It's the intention of organic gardening is to feed microbes, but the microbes have to be there to be fed. And you want to think about it, it's kind of like adding the yeast to make the bread. You know, try drinking a beer without yeast. It defines the process, right? So that transformation of organic matter, the leaves in a forest, into plant food doesn't just happen. It doesn't just melt. It has to be accomplished by diverse microbes.
So can you explain that issue? Because that's come up a few different ways. We've heard people say just going to get the big bag of Miracle-Gro to enrich your soil may have a short-term impact. But what does that really do? What's the effect?
Yeah, well, great question because it draws a parallel in the whole conversation that we're having. Miracle-Gro is fast food for plants. It, you know, put numbers on it. A plant has to have 17 elements to grow. Those are called the essential elements. If one of those elements isn't present, the plant can't form. Miracle-Gro's got 7 elements at the most in it. So it's half, less than half of what the plant has to have. It's actually taking advantage of your soil because when you run out and are deficient in the things you're not adding, all things fall apart, and that's pests and diseases. No different than what happens to us when we eat fast food for every meal. We make movies out of it, right? I mean, we've kind of sold ourselves on this idea that it's true for our own health, but we don't apply it to the soil, which you know, ironically, is what creates the fast food scenario that we're dealing with. So you kind of have this catch-22, and you really kind of have to think your way out of it, you know, what we think we grow. So if you're approaching your soil from a standpoint of mineral diversity and biological diversity, you can't help but grow healthier food, and that's going to reinforce the whole nature of the conversation that we're trying to have with the with our society, for that matter.
What kinds of food crops can we grow? Jill Wadey, what kinds of things are being grown in the community garden at Rankin Terrace, for instance?
Well, right now, it's at Hillcrest. Right now, it's just kale because of the way the season is. They're planning a big, like, planting day, I think, on May 1st, where they're going to put in some of the crops. I'm not sure what they've grown in the past. But they have that community garden. They have some gardens in schools through the Food Corps program. So they have people who are in this program where it takes recent college graduates, puts them in some of these low-income schools, teach classes about healthy fruits and vegetables, plants the garden with the students, you know, has them eat these, see how delicious it is right from the garden, stuff like that. So I'm not sure exactly what they're planting, but you're teaching children from a young age about these good foods.
Evan Folds, what do you think are good crops that people can plant in their yards and grow fairly easily here?
Whatever you like. You know, we live, it's interesting, we don't view ourselves as an agricultural community, but before 1960, we were the breadbasket of the South. You know, we have ideal growing conditions. We don't have ideal soil, but that can be handled very effectively. You know, we give compost tea away to anybody who's never tried it if they come into the store, and that's a way of growing your soil and starting to get these kinds of results. So as far as the crop, you would just want to look at the season that you're in, cold season, warm season crops. But you can actually have a year-round agricultural environment in your landscape in Wilmington. It's very conducive, much more so than most other places, actually. It's just a matter of getting the fundamentals right, of getting that soil right so that you can have success. The number one thing that's discouraging about gardening is you put all of the effort into it and nothing, you don't get anything out of it. You know, it's really difficult to do that year after year. So
the basis of that is the soil, and the compost is one of the best methods for enriching the soil. What are other things that people might need to do in a lot of the yards here southeastern North Carolina?
In simple terms, a lot of the technical nature of how we approach our landscapes, which we learn by researching it through kind of the expert channels, it's a bit, you know, I'm in no way picking on doctors because I know a lot of very brilliant and qualified they're all well-meaning, but the reality is doctors are trained to manage symptoms. They're not trained to heal people. And, you know, they don't ask people to change their diets in the same way that they'll prescribe a pill to alleviate the symptom. And so there's no judgment there. That's their job. So what we're kind of talking about is not taking the pill. Don't go kill the pest. It's the pest doing what it's supposed to do. It's trying to put your plants out of misery because they're sick. You know, the soil's bad. Disease is no different. We just talked about that a minute ago. Incidentally, weeds are medicinal herbs. You know, you could buy them at Tidal Creek if you wanted to for your health, and they're trying to do the same thing for the landscape. So you can kind of see, you know, not going too past the surface there, that the perspective that you hold really drives the action that you undertake. And if you try to kill your problem, you're making it worse. So you take a step back, you introduce, you know, think about the ocean. The strength is of the food web is in the diversity, and that's really the same way in the soil.
Jill Wadey, just a couple of minutes left. If you were queen of the world, how would you like to see public policy change to address some of these food access, healthy food access issues?
It's difficult. I think it has to start on the community level, and that's what this great program, Feast Down East, is doing through a food sovereignty program. So they're engaging with people who are food insecure about getting their own access. So the fresh food markets in Rankin Terrace and Hillcrest, residents actually run them with help from one of our Vista volunteers. But that's really important to get the community involved and not just, you know, here you go, but having them involved in getting their own access to these issues. Other things for farmers markets, especially getting them all to have access to a card reader so people can bring their SNAP benefit cards and use that in order to purchase some of these fresh fruits and vegetables.
That something that can happen now or not the case?
Yeah, so a lot of farmers markets in the country do have that. I'm not sure about the one in Wilmington because I just moved here, like I was saying. But some places will even double your SNAP dollars. So if you go there, you can get twice as much money to buy fruits and vegetables at the farmers market. So those are some really great ideas to try to get people better access.
Evan Folds, final thoughts.
Oh, well, first, you know, I just would really appreciate the opportunity to talk about these kinds of things to a wider group of people. But I would really challenge people to think strongly about what they want to see in regards to their food system and the way in which we engage it and the buying power that we enlist and the means in which we involve ourselves in that are really the fundamental tenets of what make it what we want. So we have the means to do it, and anybody who has an interest, you know, please do seek us out. We're open 7 days a week on Oleander Drive, and we'd love to talk with you about it and get you involved.
Well, that's this edition of Coastline, and I'd like to thank both of our guests, Jill Wadey of UNCW and Evan Folds of Progressive Gardens and Progressive Farms. Thanks also to you, our listeners, those of you who emailed and called in. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Join us for the next Coastline. Seismic testing off the North Carolina coast is the next step towards offshore drilling. We'll hear about potential impacts on marine life from a scientific perspective. That's next Wednesday at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.